Andrew Durbin brought out MacArthur Park. Kind of extraordinary novel. It's a slow start and then grips you and you won't let go. and it was recommended by a friend of mine. I couldn't stop, but then I really stayed very much with me. And when we invited Andrew, I have to admit that I did not know that he was the senior editor of Frieze. And then very fortuitously, Andrew said, you know, we said, well, who would you like to speak with? And he said, well, actually, I got a call a while back from T.J. Wilcox asking me to lunch to discuss the novel. And so we thought this is a wonderful way to have an intimate conversation among colleagues and friends. And I know many of you know T.J. and Andrew well. So please welcome Andrew and T.J.
Hey, TJ.
Hi. It seems like we're really far apart.
I know. This is like
and sort of on a chat show, which is nice. But, so it is true that I totally fanned out and read this book and called Andrew and said, I loved your book and I'd like to talk to you about it. So we're maybe going to do that again, but publicly.
Yeah.
And with less alcohol.
Less alcohol and less dim sum.
Yeah.
You were like the best reader of my book that I'd ever had.
Because
you're
on.
Like, let's just have dumplings and talk about your work for like 2 hours. And it was like...
Well, it was fun and I appreciated it. And so if you haven't read MacArthur Park, please do. Well, I think you might enjoy it. So I have some notes.
Okay.
I'm going to start this conversation over, I guess. Maybe I should say something about, I have this funny overlap in the way that Tom just said he didn't know when he invited Andrew to speak that you were the senior editor of Frieze. I also have this funny overlap with Frieze because I share a space with Frieze, their offices and my studio. And that has been the case for almost 10 years because one of the founders of Frieze, Amanda Sharp, and I are old friends. And when she was looking for offices for Frieze in New York, she had heard that I had a good space on Union Square. And so I invited her to the office, and Frieze ended up moving there, and it was in that studio where I made a piece called In the Air, which is a panorama film that I showed at the Whitney Museum about 4 years ago. And that was a great opportunity to use this space, and I got to meet all these nice Frieze people. And then, since every story in New York City is very often a real estate story, Frieze and I were kicked out of the building, and we all moved to Soho together. And that's where I met Andrew when he started to be involved in with Frieze. Maybe I should sort of what I've done. Oh, I was also going to say for those of you who don't know, Andrew has had an exciting 2 weeks. He was hit by a car, and so we've organized this or not organized this in a slightly unusual way. I mean, I'm a visual artist, and we're not going to show any visuals relating to me. We're really going to keep this in language, and we probably would have had a studio visit before this talk, but he's been in hospital and then recuperating at home, so we're so happy.
I'm happy to be here. I'm sad we didn't have the studio visit.
But I'm happy that you, yeah, that as awful as it was.
Yeah.
Because I think watch out for pot dealing, texting.
Well, let's not say too much about the driver yet. I'm still like dealing with.
It's still being litigated. Her lawyers are probably here right now.
just strike that from the record.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Never mind. We're glad you're here. So maybe I'll sort of dive in. Oh, so what I thought I would do is I sort of quickly had the pleasure of rereading the book in the last couple of days again, and I've gone through and chosen a few sections that really resonated with me, and I thought that I might read some short passages to you, and Andrew hopefully has something to say about them, and maybe there'll be some overlap with my work that I can add to that or not. But well, first, is there anything you would like to say about the novel before I dive in?
No, I guess it is a slow start, now that I think about it. It is a bit of a slow start. I have nothing to say about the novel, because I guess I wrote it, so it's kind of one of those funny situations. I mean, I guess I could say very basically, for those of you who haven't read the novel, it came out in 2017. I wrote it over the course of, so I began the novel shortly after Hurricane Sandy, and the novel kind of opens with this moment where the narrator is house-sitting an apartment in the West Village, and the power goes out, and he's kind of thrown for a loop in this way, where suddenly the kind of comforts of the city dissolve around him, and he becomes unaware of what's exactly happening, the extent of the disaster, etc. And so then the novel becomes about the kind of long tail of anxiety that accompanies any kind of accident, like a car accident, or like a tragedy, like a kind of terrible hurricane. And the novel then devolves into this consideration of the way crisis shapes us and the communities we belong to and attempt to join in different ways. And the novel kind of looks at different people. So it moves from New York to Miami to California, back to New York, and then to London, and kind of looks at these different groupings of people and how they think about the disasters that are affecting their lives in different ways. The kinds of like psychological weather that we're all kind of experiencing at any given moment. That would be my introduction to the novel. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I think that makes sense. The novel conflates, it is driven by a protagonist, a narrator called Nick, mm-hmm. and but it moves in its references through many different subjects, from global warming to American cults to artist retreats in upstate New York to folk medicine to California as an idea and kind of separatist communities generally. Basically, I would describe it as a kind of search for coping mechanisms in the American psyche, in a way. But there was something I wanted to read about what you described, crisis fueling the novel, in a way. And you write, crisis gives us shape, the contours of sympathetic form. Whether we call it forth or not, whether or not it happened to us as we claim or remember it did, I decided not to tell her about my own experience in the storm, which amounted to nothing more than that of a casual, removed observer, standing safely from afar, my face briefly lit in the white fire of the power plant explosion. Was that even true, or had my mind added that detail later? To place myself among accountable things, since I was otherwise left in the abstract space of someone else's apartment, just at the edge of disaster. I could have said anything about my past. It seemed in any case that one condition of the mediated present was not simply disaster itself and its immediate and obvious effects on a given reality, measurable in loss of life, loss of capital, loss of property, but the peripheral warp in the communication systems that had become central to our lives, stray tweets, hashtags, Facebook posts, news alerts, text messages, all of it evidence that something is happening, something often on the edge, in some close or far elsewhere, whether you are in it or not, a jittery closed-circuit paranoia of an event where it remains unclear who's there and whether it is even happening as it is said to be happening, given the diffuse authority of the speakers, the tellers of the disaster. I think that this kind of describes the horror of the present as we all live it in a way. And I was wondering if you could, this seems to me to be a kind of central passage in terms of your approach to constructing the characters concerned in the novel. And I was wondering if you could say, you know, more about what you've written in this section.
Yeah, I think it is probably like one of the key germs of the novel in many ways, from which like everything else kind of spreads out and percolates and derives its meaning. You know, around the time that I was working on the novel, which was spread out over the course of like 3 or 4 years, I was reading a lot about not only like kind of climate news, but also kind of climate theory, and not particularly the ways that scientists are thinking about the world changing, but the way that theorists are thinking about how we talk about it. And a book that was really important to me at the time was this book called Slow Violence by Rob Nixon. And that book is really presents climate change as a kind of a question of representation in many ways, because kind of in many ways the communities that are feeling the most immediate and drastic effects of climate change, it's both super fast in that you could have like a kind of like a hurricane or a mudslide or something, whatever may be related to a kind of a warming trend or whatever. But at the same time, it can also be quite slow. So the ways in which different ecosystems gradually collapse. And one of the problems posited by this book is how do you talk about the slow violence of climate change, because in many ways it kind of resists the way that we think about any kind of fiction or film, where it's always kind of stated in terms of these like concentrated dramas, like a hurricane striking New York City. So in the book I really wanted to think both on the level of that the dramatic, what is really the kind of remit of a novel, and then also I wanted to think very much on the level of the slowed down psychic degree of climate change. And of course, as like a white New Yorker, my experience is very different than someone in, say, the Philippines. So I wasn't really attempting to represent that. But I was trying to represent the way that I think that our minds are changed by climate change, and this sense of a kind of, this kind of like always existing crisis state, that the biosphere is kind of constantly undergoing these crippling events that are difficult for someone in New York, or even difficult for someone in London, or even in like small town Pennsylvania, to really perceive. And yet I think we all, or most of us, have this kind of atmosphere, this weather we're living in, which kind of is beyond the weather itself and is really related to the a kind of sense of impending doom. And I think with that particular passage, the narrator is addressing this woman whose house was destroyed in Queens, and she's a bit of a liar in the novel. She's like untrustworthy on some level. And he kind of questions her a little bit, and he thinks like, is she really telling it how it is? And then he thinks, am I really telling it how it is? And then like, what does it even mean to say? So there's this moment in the novel where he thinks about like being in it, and like the ways in which like that being in it can be so complicated. I mean, I experienced this recently with a car accident where with 2 weeks later, my memory is quite fresh, but then there are all these added layers, of course, of the traumas and the anxieties and the revisionary memories. And so I wanted to think not about the event itself, but the kind of long tail of an event, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I you touched on this already, but I've been interested in this idea that we seem to be collectively addicted to these 24-hour news cycles that feed a climate of, you know, constant fear and sense of impending disaster. And that seems to be a kind of meta-narrative in the novel generally, that the characters are all kind of reacting to this internalized sense that The Sky Is Falling, and tried to kind of cope with that as an ongoing, you know, reality. This sort of addictive nature of our mediated lives that are, the content of which is often sort of fueled by tales of woe and dread, and that seems to be something the characters are constantly, you know, reacting to and trying to cope with.
Yeah. And they kind of, in different ways, look for meaning in art and history, and, you know, I mean, there's characters who are, you know, they join cults and all that kind of stuff, and they don't really satisfy in many ways. But there's this constant, I think, in the novel, like searching through the kind of silt of history for the kinds of images and the kinds of stories that can be taken forward into the present and used to survive. I mean, I think in some ways that's similar to your work, this like return to history to kind of reconstruct a narrative. You know, you and I have talked a little bit about, like, even thinking about your Marie Antoinette film, or I mean, any David Bowie, who we both are big fans of, these kind of like almost dead images where they've been so so distributed and they're so absorbed into the culture that you think, like, what can I do with that now? But that becomes quite interesting. And I think the characters have this difficulty on some level too, where they think, like, what can I do with the present, given that the present is everywhere all the time? It's always a media event. So how can I make any kind of personal meaning out of it? And that becomes a real struggle almost immediately for the narrator and then the other characters.
This will to make sense of the senseless, in a way. It kind of reminds me of a brush with madness that I experienced. I had a stalker event in my life, which I hope doesn't happen again today. I hope none of you are about to have a psychic break, because I was giving I was speaking at the Walker Art Center once, and on that day, somebody in the audience had a complete mental break, and I became the object of her madness, essentially. And she started to, she got my phone number and address from my gallery, from an intern at the gallery, and started to call me and write me, you know, hourly. And her real beef with me was that I wouldn't stop controlling her with my mental telepathy, which is a problem of mine, generally. And she eventually started to say that if I didn't stop, I would, she would kill herself. And so I was able to get the police involved, and they finally went to her home, and they had to knock down the doors, and they found her inside, and every surface of every wall was covered with diagrams, mathematical type diagrams that she was using to explain to herself how it was that my mental telepathy was adversely affecting her life. And I thought this was so interesting, in a way, that the mind, whether it's well or unwell, desperately wants to explain itself to itself, wants to find some kind of coping mechanism. And she found this exterior reason for the things that she was feeling and experiencing in the world. She understood herself to be sane and centered, and there was an outside force that was affecting her in this negative way, in this case, me. Your characters present themselves as sane, but they're all searching for this magic bullet of, you know, rationality, you know, to kind of explain the random and chaotic nature of life to themselves, it seems, in very American ways.
I mean, the characters are searching for, to me, like, I think they're searching for the fiction that they're in, because they're, you know, like, I think you're right in the sense that we're all kind of like looking for coping mechanisms, maybe like a more basic way of saying is that we're always kind of searching for patterns that kind of from which we can derive a kind of meaning. And of course, like, life exists outside of those kinds of, I mean, life has patterns, but it's really a kind of disorganized series of events. And I think that my characters are kind of looking for this like structuring fiction, which of course they already exist within. And I think that as a writer, that's kind of what I'm always thinking about with my own life, because my work is a kind of mix of autobiographical, essayistic, like more explicitly fictional work. And so I think we all kind of search, maybe in some of the ways that maybe that woman is searching for, like, the kind of, like, answer to what is otherwise just normal life, you know? And for me, I think my solution is, like, fiction.
But you approach that in a very interesting way, because you kind of deny resolve. You know, your book leads in so many different directions simultaneously, and it kind of suggests answers, but it never comes back around and ties itself together. And that seems to be a real strategy in terms of how you've about the kind of fundamental structure of that you imagine for the book, that, you know, it doesn't all tie together in a tidy way in the end. And that feels very deliberate to me, and I was hoping you could say something about that as an approach to constructing a novel in this form.
Yeah, I really like incoherence, structural incoherence. I think that makes for, like, a really interesting kind of books. Like, I like the ways in which, like, plot lines kind of leak into one another rather than, like, kind of merge. I guess I should say, like, a little bit about myself. I started off as a poet, kind of not great poet, and I really wanted to make... every poem I was writing just kind of devolved into a really terrible short story for so long. And I thought, man, I really should just try narrative. And I didn't study writing in school, and I didn't study, like, how to write a novel. So, like, I kind of did everything in a bit of reverse. The publisher who worked with me on the book is here, actually, and he could really speak to this, because he saw every draft for, like, 5 years. And I really kind of wrote it all backwards. It's like it was like getting a very elaborate IKEA piece and just throwing out the instructions, and you just kind of, like, move, you just kind of, like, look at things, and you think, like, and by the end, it kind of works, but you have a bunch of leftover parts. That's kind of how I wrote this novel.
Actually, there's a passage that I just remembered that mm-hmm. kind of describes this. It almost feels like a mini manifesto or something buried in it.
I love this manifestos.
This is on, for your sake, this is on page 141.
Yeah, because I don't remember the book that well.
It's been a while for you. It's at the very end of 141. You're in the bar.
Oh, yeah, this is my favorite part.
It's happening now.
I'm serious.
It being disaster, the disarray that continues to push and define present conditions, always beginning elsewhere, in the far north, in the far south, at sea, and landing at your doorstep. At the bar, surrounded by others like me who were bored or curious or lonely or, in their way, a little frightened, I contemplated my mask, which was also my hopelessness, or not my hopelessness so much as my future, which was also my hopelessness, my present extremity. Over a whiskey, I resolved to make something of it, a writing that would attempt to describe and account for the state of things, the state being disaster, that would in turn look like a writing that would become a book, one that organizes the anxiety of that extremity into a fiction or an essay or a poetry, or a thing that reads like all three: winds, oceans, land masses, cracks, fissures, floods, stress points, breakage. Wigs of weather we wear to convince ourselves that we are something that we are not. Springs like summer, falls like fall, falls like summer, winters like summer, the planet of summer and its eternal present.
Yeah, that was a manifesto, I think, a bit. So I really like, do you know, like, this thing, I always think about this, it's like drag queen mentality, where you always point where you're going on stage, so you're like, and you go that way, you go that way. This was me, like, pointing where I'm going, and that's why I put the word wigs of weather in.
Wigs of weather is so cool.
Yeah.
You're wearing a wig of weather.
Yeah, that's I really imagine, like, this kind of hurricane.
When I write for... my films are often subtitled, and I have a very limited amount of time to write for the screen because you can only get so many words on in a single frame, and so the narrative stories that I tell often I have to write them and rewrite them, and they get kind of distilled down to this very, I hope, taut language, and I noticed this throughout your novel that you're very talented at distilling language into these very visual, very taut, descriptive sentences, which I really admired.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first finished the book, it was really had not a lot. It was like kind of a mess. It was much longer, and it was kind of unclear what was going on. So actually, this came out in a later revision where I thought I needed to kind of give this a little more shape and a little more ideas. And so that particular moment where, so the mask is referring to the narrator sees this Pierre Huig human, this Lacma show where Pierre Huig's film, Human Mask, I think it's called, where a monkey is wearing a human mask and kind of wandering around this house. So the narrator sees this and then he's thinking about the masks he's wearing in different ways and this like mask of hopelessness. And I became really interested in the ways in which like the accoutrements of disaster also, and the accoutrements of feeling, you know, the ways in which we kind of create metaphors that act as like kind of surrogate body parts, if that makes sense. I mean, I think when you live in like a, I think when you kind of face any kind of crisis, whether it's very personal or impersonal, like a kind of weather event, there's all these distancing mechanisms or coping mechanisms you kind of create for yourself where you learn to work with tragedy. And so I became interested in my writing and like ways that I could kind of visualize that. So feeling like my face had no longer been my face, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes. You also seem to... You seem to be working through in the novel ways that people are also trying to understand technology's interface in their lives. And I've been interested in my own work in how the technology of a particular period, you know, whether it's, for example, Super 8 or 16 millimeter film conditioning the way that we remember the 60s or the 70s, as opposed to our memories of the 80s being conditioned by like the quality of early VHS video. You know, that technology can actually enter into our minds and kind of affect the way that we recall the past to ourselves within our own interior kind of dreamscape of imagery. You seem to be interested in how the current conditions of a mediated life have affected people's experience of life and their imaginings of their of themselves,
yeah,
in the world.
Yeah, well, I think this is like an overlap between us and the kind of interest, going back to what I was saying earlier about this, like these existing histories that we kind of can derive narratives from, but also this existing pool of images, whether they're iconic, like Marie Antoinette or something like that, or if they're simply like you know, CNN, which is being broadcast all the time, in all different kinds of ways. So, you know, I mean, one thing that I've always been intrigued in your work is the way that you've gone back to these image fields almost, which are kind of circumscribed by a single person, like Marlene Dietrich or something like that. And then you kind of mine from that a kind of, you take that iconography and you find something else within it, you know, and construct new narratives or a new kind of, way of thinking through something in a very contemporary feeling way. And I think that that's something that I also feel, in my first book, Mature Themes, God rest its soul, I thought a lot about celebrities in that particular piece where I you know, each section was like Katy Perry or Lil Wayne or Ciara, and I tried to take these individuals whose work I really admired in different ways, or Kanye West, and like write about them in a very personal way that kind of defamiliarized them as figures, and allowed them to become a kind of self-portraiture for me in some ways. And I think that's something we kind of like a kind of sensibility that we share in some way. I mean,
you also talk about something that interests me, which is a kind of access we all or memories we all have access to that are mediated, that kind of exist floating in a technological bubble, kind of outside, alongside of people. And there's something that you write about, and this is a passage where the Nick, the protagonist, is having a date with a boyfriend that he's sort of conflicted about. This is page 38. Pursuing in a direct way, and they're having a kind of late night, drug fueled, hanging out, watching videos moment. And you write, we were sitting in front of his computer as dawn set loose its pale colors against the dark silhouette of the city. A video of David Bowie and Cher from sometime in the 70s played on YouTube. It was an improbable but gorgeous duet, their two wraith-like figures flickering in the bad transfer on the screen, rumored to be so high on good cocaine themselves as to have no memory of their performance once it was done. And yet, in Bowie's steady canter, there was an almost totalizing sense of the memory that he had performed this before, that this song, like all the events to which a song belongs, was an act of memorializing a previous song that had already been sung, a past performance. The last rosary bead before the next he threaded through his fingers. All the same, so what was remembering it? It's a continuous, unending loop. There was no song outside that song. Bowie had the sharpest teeth. It was like he was sucking the blood out of the air. Cher was crowned with a dome of orange hair. I liked this idea of a mediated kind of cultural touchstone that exists in this digital eternal to which people have this odd access to, that seems to have a kind of contemporary life of its own that floats in some netherworld. And that idea seems to come up again and again in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the novel is thinking about, like, it's like less interested in the end in remembering and more interested in awareness. Because it's kind of like takes for, maybe a bit for granted, that so much of what is occurring within the confines of the novel that are like public events, whether it's like a performance like that or a hurricane, are like matters of public record. So then it becomes ways in which the narrator is becoming aware of those records and then like arranging them into like patterns of meaning that can then become what is essentially the novel. If that, you know, I guess that would be my, I really liked that video, and so I just really wanted to write about it in the moment. So.
I don't know, I get that sense all the time that sometimes you just have something that you want to write about, you know.
Yeah, the problem with this novel. The problem with this novel is it's like filled with things that I was like, you know, I should just write about that.
And yes, it didn't really but you are someone who writes about art and artists all the time, and you spend a great deal of time in this novel talking about Wolfgang Tillmans and Greer Langton, and they don't seem to be random or artists that you chose haphazardly. They seem to be real touchstones in this book. You know, can you talk about like why they needed to be described?
Yeah. I wish I had a really good answer. The answer is, you know, the way I did learn about writing fiction was through like a collection of writers who live on like the same block of San Francisco, like new narrative writing in the 1970s and 80s. Bruce Boone, Bob Gluck, Kevin Killian, Dodie Bellamy, those are the novelists that I really was thinking about always, but when I was writing this book in particular. And, you know, this book is really a kind of homage in some ways to that work, and one of the kind of definitive features of that work is that it's derived so directly from their lives, and they kind of, it becomes not so much about the way you're constructing a plot, so much as your the way you construct filters for information. So, kind of everything falls into these books, but, or not everything, but it becomes really about selecting what you want in there, and, but it's often derived from just their day-to-day experience. So, in particular with MacArthur Park, I know Wolfgang, and we went to a party together, and at the time I had been commissioned by a magazine to write an essay about Greer Langton, who's an artist I really like, and Wolfgang and I were at the party, and he said, oh, I'm shooting the photos for that, and I was like, oh, great, and then, you know, I wrote a chapter about Wolfgang at the party, because it was really fun to see him there, because it was like, I had wanted to write about this nightclub for a long time, and I knew the novel already had these scenes in it. And then later, he kind of literally walked into it, and all these people, it was this amazing moment, it's in the novel, but he walks into the club, and of course, somehow everyone recognizes Wolfgang Tillmans, and I didn't really know what Wolfgang Tillmans looked like before that night, and suddenly everyone was freaking out, because they thought, oh, he's going to take my photograph, and everyone was just, it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen, because everyone was beautiful. They suddenly became a photograph. Everyone had the potential to be in David Zwirner, suddenly. And it was really wonderful to watch. And I'm not that type of person. I didn't want to have my photograph taken. So I was kind of able to just watch this. And people were coming up to me and said, oh, do you know Wolfgang Tillman? And I said, I do. And they're like, do you think he'll take my photograph? And I said, maybe, I don't know. And like, then at the time, you know, so then I put that in, and then I put in the thing about Greer Langton, because then Wolfgang illustrated the Greer Langton piece I wrote, and I was like, well, I'll just throw the essay in there, and then we kind of have this kind of funny continuity. But there's no real...
Well, I don't know about that. You say there's no... I mean, I think that he's such an interesting example in the sense that he does kind of represent, in this moment where so many people seem to be living for the distribution of their mediated image, that he is an interesting subject. I mean, I've known Wolfgang, I'm much older than Andrew, and I've known Wolfgang since the 90s, and when I met Wolfgang and met him actually in a club, he had a camera, and in those days that was weird, that someone should have a camera in a nightclub, and when he's very surreptitious when he takes his camera out, but he would image people, and I remember people being more startled by that, or if they noticed, you know, because there was no obvious distribution system for those photographs, and you sort of didn't know why this guy was taking photos of you, but the evening kind of carried on, and everyone was drunk or whatever, and fast forward 20 years, the world has totally changed, and so I am always fascinated moving through the world by how children, very young children, have their photograph faces. You know, children now, the mind seems to be in this entirely evolutionary phase, and young children know their good angle from like the age of 3 now. You know, that you see people arrange themselves on the street for their selfie moment. And I find these poses that you see people, our office is in Soho, so I'm always walking through these kind of touristy places with lots of selfie backdrops, and I'm fascinated by how people of every age know how to compose themselves for images, for image making now, in a way that just didn't exist in my lifetime. And anyway, so he seems very particular, and I think that Greer seems very particular too. For those of you who don't know her work, she made a series of dolls for decades, and there was one of these dolls, she made a whole kind of cast of characters from Andy Warhol to Diana Vreeland to a world of her heroes. But there was one doll in particular that meant a great deal to her that I think was called Sissy, and that she never definitively completed, and it evolved over many years. And there's a section that in this, in the book, this is 217, where you are describing this work on her best-known doll. Langton worked on her best-known doll, Sissy, 1979 through 1996, for most of her career. It has since disappeared. Numerous photos of the doll still exist, providing an elliptical portrait taken by Langton of the doll's progression. In one, perched on a stoop and smoking a cigarette next to a small dog, Sissy looks like Joan Crawford. In another, it's broken into pieces, a dislocated and partially skeletal nude descending a staircase. In still another, Sissy is naked, wigless, and with a red heart painted on its chest. Perhaps the most famous image of the doll is of it standing with a skull cap outside the Prince Street N&R train station in Soho. Sissy's pants are pulled down to reveal male genitals. Graffiti on the station reads, "Lady." It seems somewhat fitting, however terrible the loss, that Sissy disappeared. A translational and transitional object of identity, its continuous shifts between identities and genders, between the fully formed and the partially skeletal, license and absence that follows Langton's own. We couldn't know Sissy except in parts, images, remnants, small traces of a figure that slipped, like its maker, above the uttermost limits of vision.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the actual, like, not to be coy, like, the core of the novel is, like, this section, which is kind of disappointing because no one ever wrote about this part. But, you know, like, the real actual link between Wolfgang and this is this particular moment, and maybe we can end here and if there's questions or something. But I was thinking about, when I wrote about Langton, when I was thinking about her work, I was thinking about this German artist, Lotte Pritzel, who Rilke had wrote about. Lotte Pritzel wrote these very similar, made these very similar dolls, and they were seen as kind of eccentric during the Weimar. And Rilke was a staunch defender of this work and wrote, "With the doll, we had to assert ourselves because if we surrendered to it there was nobody there. It made no response, so we got into the habit of doing things for it, splitting our own slowly expanding nature into opposing parts, and to some extent using the doll to establish distance between ourselves and the amorphous world pouring into us." And so then I write, kind of connecting this to, and this is what I think like becomes like a kind of description of not only the people at the club that Wolfgang is photographing, and he's also photographing these particular dolls, but it becomes a kind of metaphor for the way that identity exists right now, which is this kind of constantly undergoing, it's a state of constant construction. But so for Pritzel, working roughly a century before Langton, this assertion of the self against and into dolls made for a sculpture of delicate figures infused with Orientalist twinkle, a toy world of near genderless bodies that, per Rilke, swam and fade at the uttermost limit of our vision, safe from any decline in permanent sensuality. This lends them a particularly dreamy quality, ghostly in the few extant images of them, because they were all destroyed. Their skeletal faces yearn for a beautiful flame to throw themselves into, like moths. Pritzel's dolls, fragile artifacts of the brief twilight between the gay 90s and the founding of the Weimar Republic, are refugees of art, caught in the difficult obscurity between toy and sculpture. So yeah, I think that was kind of like an I was thinking about, in the end, like, the way in which, like, this is toward the end of the novel, and after this whole consideration of crisis and disaster and the kind of deformities that a personality and a self undergoes through contemporary life, in the end, I kind of rested on this image of the doll as this interesting, in particularly, like, Sissy, as this way of thinking about ourselves as this, like, a kind of, like, potentially always containing within it, like a Whitmanic idea, like containing multitudes and this potential constantly for like a kind of revised self to emerge every few seconds, whatever it may be. And those particular figures at the spectrum with Wolfgang are kind of aware of that in a way that the narrator isn't until later. Like, he kind of is seeing this as a kind of humorous moment of these people constructing themselves suddenly, you know, like standing up straight and looking beautiful and wiping the sweat from their eyes, their brow. He sees this as kind of funny, but then later he realizes that this is the way people live today.
Gavin Brown had a
bar attached to his gallery on 15th Street. And it's remembered as being called Passerby, but it's named after a bar in Paris that had a famous neon sign in the window. And the neon sign flashed, Passerby, be modern. And really the name of Gavin's bar was Passerby, be modern. And I think your novel is very modern.
It's the Rimbaud idea, you know, we must be absolutely modern.
That's the novel's idea. Anyway, that's where I want to leave this, right. Unless somebody has some questions.
Hello, it was a wonderful talk. You mentioned dealing with crisis about creating a different face and establishing an identity, and this talk just keeps ringing, and it's like, yes. And also these ideas of constantly establishing our identity and our narrative. But when I hear this, for me, it strikes a bit too close to like the idea of schizophrenia in the postmodern society, which for me causes a bit of an alarm. It has a more of a negative connotation. But do you think like that's the norm now and that's how we deal with this constant state of crisis? Or how do you see that like progress?
I try not to use like medical metaphors to describe reality. So like I wouldn't call it like a schizophrenic society or a schizophrenic world, because schizophrenia is a diagnosable condition that the mind has. But I would say that our world contains, as it probably always has, we've had six extinction events, lots of contradictory calamitous elements that are at war with themselves, and that can't help but kind of mold our own lives and personalities. You know, to be a bit corny, everything is kind of connected on some level, but truly, I mean, that's the idea of a biosphere, and we live in a biosphere, and it's our only one. So anything that happens in, say, Indonesia or the South Pacific in a remote quarter of the world will eventually affect us, and that can't help but change the way we think about the world and our personality. And particularly when you're dealing with it through the kind of mediation of CNN or Fox or any number of things, I think this particular moment is interesting because a lot of these concerns are like oddly suspended because of Trump and the situation, and like there's been this like refocus toward like a single person. And he's become like the kind of umbrella for everything, but it kind of distracts from, like I'm eager to like get back to when we're actually thinking a bit about like what's actually happening in the world a little more. I mean, many people are, but our televisions aren't. So I don't know if that answers your question.
All right, well, thank you very much. So if you just if you are, thank you TJ, thank you Andrew, superb.
Thank
you very much. And just to note, tomorrow if you're coming back to the fair, our last talk in the series is with a terrific author, Valeria Luiselli, Mexican-American author, just wrote a book, came out a couple of months ago called Children, The Lost Archive, and she'll be speaking with the Canadian artist Terence Gow. That's at 12:30 tomorrow. Thank you.